Welcome to the Gay Buddhist Forum, where teachers from all schools of Buddhism offer their perspectives on the Dharma and its application in modern times, especially for LGBTQI audiences. These talks are offered freely to the world and made possible by appreciative listeners. If you would like to support our efforts to share the Dharma with underserved audiences, please visit gaybuddhist.org. There you can donate, find a list of upcoming speakers, or enjoy many hundreds of these recorded talks dating back to 1996.
All right, welcome back, everyone. Welcome to the Gay Buddhist Fellowship. Today, we're going to hear from our speaker, Eugene Cash. He's the founding teacher of Insight Meditation Community of San Francisco. He teaches at Spirit Rock Meditation Center and leads intensive meditation retreats internationally. His teaching is influenced by both Burmese and Thai streams of Theravada tradition, as well as Zen and Tibetan Buddhist practice. He's also a teacher of the Diamond Approach, a school of spiritual investigation and self-realization, developed by A.L. Amas. And take it away. Thank you for joining us.
Great. Hi, everybody. Nice to be back with you. It's been a while. Good to see a number of you who I recognize and, you know, who maybe I've seen somewhere else, but also seen you here before. What I'd like to talk about was actually a talk that somebody asked me to give from SF Insight, where I teach. And I was asked to give a talk about that was both personal and also about the world and living in the world, personal about the Dharma and about dukkha, about difficulty, about dukkha is mostly translated as suffering, or dis-ease, or unsatisfactoriness of life. That's part of all life. And of course, you can always let me know if you've never had any dukkha or anything like that, but most of us have had a taste of it. You know, depending on your age, usually the longer we live, the more tastes we get to have. But what I was asked to teach about how to relate to the dukkha of life and how to do it gracefully. And the movement of the Dharma is a change in perspective. And the change is characterized by what Joko Beck, who is a Zen teacher, said, called ABC, that practice is about a bigger container, about the manifestation or the creation of a bigger container to understand reality, to understand the truth, to understand this moment, and to understand our experience day by day and week by week and year by year, and our experience together in the world. And graceful, of course, comes from the word grace, which means dignified or discerning or cultivated is how we grace arises. And it has a kind of, I like words, so I always look up the words that are key that I'm going to use. And grace has a sense of fluidity or suppleness or naturalness, and is also a kind of precision or agility to it, often related to the arts. Right. People are talked about being graceful dancers or a graceful musician and things like that. And there's a kind of inherent grace in the arts when we're there, when we're fully in it, doing it. The dancers, when they're doing it, they aren't thinking about a million things. They're right in the experience itself. And I find the arts and meditation practice very similar. Because when we're meditating, we want to be right here, right now, right in this experience, whether we're formally meditating or whether we're doing contemplative practice 24/7, even now. And so, of course, I want to encourage you to practice while you're listening to me, just as I want to practice while I'm speaking and while we're interacting, because it's all happening now, right? Reality is right here, and it's only right here, right now, right? You all know that the past is gone and the future is just an imagination, right? And all that's happening is here. Our whole life is here, right in this moment. And so even to be aware of it, to feel the aliveness that is both speaking and that you're listening from, the aliveness where your listening comes from, is part of what encourages grace to arise. And especially grace as a kind of I was surprised when I looked up the word. It had a few words that I didn't expect in the definition, which included elegance, refinement, goodwill. And of course, in it, in one of the definitions was it's the blessing of the Holy Spirit in the Christian tradition. And I thought that's all beautiful, because part of what the grace of the Dharma is the grace of actually being here, relaxing with what's true, with relaxing with this moment, even when there's dukkha, even when there's difficulty, even when it's unsatisfactory. Thich Nhat Hanh, the great Vietnamese monk teacher, he said, handling our suffering is an art. Handling our suffering is an art. If we know how to suffer, we suffer much less. We're no longer afraid of being overwhelmed by the suffering. And it's beautiful understanding of the grace of the Dharma at a certain point. It's not that we don't suffer. It's not that there's no dukkha anymore. That I can guarantee you that piece. But the fact is we can allow it. We can be with it. We can wake up. Not just to it, but through it, we can wake up. And of course, we can respond skillfully to dukkha, to the way things are, to difficulty. Flannery O'Connor, who was a novelist, she said, "Give me the courage to stand the pain to get to the grace." Give me the courage to stand the pain to get to the grace. And of course, Oscar Wilde said it most beautifully, because he had his own art of speaking about life. Oscar said, "Where there is sorrow, there is holy ground. Where there is sorrow, there is holy ground." And it's really the understanding in Buddhism, dukkha, and the cause of dukkha leads to the end of dukkha, which leads to freedom. And that's really a shorthand of the Four Noble Truths. There's dukkha, there's a cause of dukkha, there's the understanding of dukkha, and then there's a path that leads to freedom. And you're all on that path. You're all here. And it's a good place to be, really, a really good place to be, meaning here. In this moment and in Sangha, and this Sangha, I don't even know how long has GBF been going. Can anybody yell it out? Or maybe you can't, maybe you're all muted. 35 years. Yeah. I mean, you know, beautiful. 35 years of Sangha is right here. And that's like, and it's a living Sangha, meaning, and of course, I'm sure some people have passed or left the Sangha, and some people have died, because that's normal, that happened, and there are new people coming. And it's so it's an alive Sangha that is that is part of the holy ground, because we get to be real here about suffering, about dukkha. So I like to read a little bit about the grace from a book called The Grace in Dying. the grace in dying, because some of you may die someday, like all of us, right? Okay, you get that. I make little jokes sometime, and I hope they don't offend anybody, but it's true. We're all going to die. Okay, thank you, Greg. Kathleen Dowell Singh, who's died in 2017, she wrote a book called The Grace in Dying, and she was a hospice worker and psychotherapist. And she said, I realized, and she's talking about working with people who are dying. And she said, I realized that what I had been witnessing in the process of dying was grace all around, shimmering and penetrating. I began with newly opened eyes to observe the subtlety of this grace and to observe the qualities of grace in those nearing death. I became aware that all of the observed qualities of the, what she calls with capital letters, nearing death experience, point to the fact that there is a profound psychoalchemy occurring here, a passage to a deeper being. And she goes on, she says, there appears to be a universal sequential progression into a deeper, subtler, and more enveloping dimensions of awareness. Right, a deeper, subtler, and more enveloping dimensions of awareness that she sees as a progression that we go into, dimensions of awareness, of identity, and of being as we begin to die. A movement from the periphery, from the outside, to the center, she says. And she wrote, she said, I realized that the transformation I was observing in people who were nearing death was the same psychoalchemy in a greatly accelerated mode that I had noticed in myself through 2.5 decades of practicing contemplative disciplines. And she ends this part. She says, I have come to believe that the time of dying affects a transformation from perceived tragedy to experience grace. Dying offers this possibility of entering the radiance, the vastness of our essential nature. The nearing death experience implies a natural and conscious reemerging with the ground of being from which we have all once unconsciously emerged. Shall I read that last part again? A little bit of it? Yeah, okay. Dying, just the last thing she says, dying offers the possibility of encountering the radiance, the vastness of our essential nature of, and I'm commenting, of what's sitting here, of what's right here already, right where you are, right sitting in your body, heart, and mind, right? And she says, and the nearing death, right, a natural and conscious reemerging with the ground of being from which we have all once unconsciously emerged, right? So it's the movement towards the center or the source of where consciousness comes from. And everybody here is conscious, which means there's consciousness here. And consciousness is sometimes in spiritual traditions referred to as the soul, or one's Buddha nature or true nature or the essence of what we are. And grace is such a beautiful understanding. And I spent many years working for Zen Hospice, and I know what she's talking about. I've seen the grace in dying. And I've also seen the grace in being alive. They both have grace. They both have beauty. They both have goodness. And we can keep realizing the essence of who and what we are as we live our lives, as we practice, because it's right here. It's not somewhere else. It's not on some mountaintop far away. It's right in San Francisco or wherever you are, wherever you may be. I don't know where people come from for this group these days, but on Zoom, sometimes it's people in Europe or sometimes on the East Coast or the country that's north of the United States called Canada or south called Mexico or any of those. what is grace? Such a beautiful contemplation. What is grace? And of course, one of the ways grace is described is in a poem by Daniel Ladinsky. He says, "What is grace? I asked God. And God said, all that happens. Then God added, when I looked perplexed, could not lovers say that every moment in their beloved's arms was grace? What is grace? I asked God, and God said, all that happens. Then God added, when I looked perplexed, could not lovers say that every moment in their beloved's arms was grace? Existence is my arms." And so you hear the perspective change to the ABCs of practice, a bigger container, a bigger view, a bigger understanding of reality, of the truth of what's here. And so grace happens on its own. We don't do grace. I hope you all get that. We don't do it. We don't make grace happen. We practice, we be ourselves, we stay right here, and then grace reveals itself in our experience, in our aliveness, and just the simple magic of being alive sometimes. In a walk in the park, there can be grace. I have the good fortune of living right next to Golden Gate Park, and I love walking in the park, and really, it's just grace every time. And that's no joke. And it doesn't mean I'm always happy or I'm always in a good mood or I'm in some Buddha realm somewhere. No, I'm here. But still, the trees and the plants and the people and the goodness of the people who take care of the park is just, it's so beautiful. And I took a walk this morning, which I normally do, like, breakfast, a walk, and then it's like, it's just amazing how many people are out in the park early in the morning this morning and having fun and being humans and being beautiful, right? They're just playing and lying around. A little later, I took a little bike ride and I was riding around and it's just the beauty of nature and the beauty of humans. And because of, you all know, we are nature also, right? We always like to go out into nature. We forget that we are nature itself, right? We are what is born and dies both, right? And of course, when I'm out in quote nature, the trees and the plants and the flowers and the beautiful flowers and there's the white building, the House of Flowers. Of course, all of that is born and dies too. All of it. It's all natural. The birth and death and the grace of magic of life arising and passing away. One of my favorite Buddhist teachers these days, Sayadaw Utejaniya, he says, "The past is gone and the future is yet to come. Both are concepts. They are not real. Right now, in this moment, everything, anything may come and anything may go, even death." And then he says, with an exclamation mark, he says, "No problem. No problem." Because it's just a moment. Right? It's not an idea. And usually we have a lot of ideas about things like death. So when I was investigating, reflecting on grace in the Sanskrit language, the word is adhisthana, which means blessings or spiritual power, especially in the Mahayana and Vajrayana tradition. It's a spiritual power that comes on its own. We don't do it. It's a blessing that comes, grace. And I found another really interesting word that I like. apophenia is the word. Apophenia. And apophenia means the perception of connections or meaning in unrelated or random phenomena. I'm going to say it again. The perception of connections or meaning in unrelated or random phenomena. And it's really about the magic of life and what happens. Because we think we all, maybe, I don't know, I shouldn't say we. Sometimes I think I'm in control of things. And then I see how little I'm in control of everything. That life is doing itself. And the connections, really, this is an understanding of karma. It's so complex that we can never understand karma, actually. But all the causes and connections for something to arise sometimes are so unrelated and random, and we can perceive it anyways, right? We see the connections or the meaning of something, even though why it happened is not clear. Right? It's all random phenomena of reality doing itself, of which we are one of the manifestations of reality. And of course, working with difficulty and grace, the great Tibetan teacher Pema Chodron said it this way. She said, when things fall apart and we're on the verge of we know not what, the test for each of us is to stay on the brink and not concretize. The spiritual journey is not about heaven and finally getting there to a place that's really swell. She says, to stay with the shakiness, to stay with a broken heart, with a rumbling stomach, with the feeling of hopelessness and wanting to get revenge, that is the path of true awakening. I mean, that's killer. This is killer Buddhism in Yujing language, what she's saying, this last part, right? Stay with the feeling of hopelessness and wanting to get revenge, that is the path of true awakening. Sticking with that uncertainty, getting the knack of relaxing in the midst of chaos, getting the knack of relaxing in the midst of chaos, learning not to panic. That is the spiritual path from Pema Chodron. And I agree, Pema, that's good teaching, good Dharma, because we're not in control. I'm sure you've all noticed we've had a very strange last year and a half. Right? Anybody get that? Like, you know, our whole world changed, like boom, all of a sudden, everything was different. And of course, to acknowledge that yesterday was 9/11, which was an important day for many people in the United States of America, changed our lives. And that day, everything changed. Our whole reality changed in that day. And the whole reality of the world changed in that day because we're such a powerful country and we had a big reaction. We didn't stay relaxed with the difficulty that happened. We didn't know how to work with it to see the causes and conditions that brought it forward. What we did was we had a very militaristic reaction and we attacked. And that's when, you know, a little later, the war in Afghanistan happened that we just ended, right? Because of what happened that one day. We were in a 20-year war because of what happened that one day. And even after we killed Osama bin Laden, who was the instigator of that day, that didn't end the war even. And so you see how if we're not willing to be with the dukkha, more dukkha happens. If we're being willing to be with the dukkha, we can learn to wake up and deal with it, respond to it, be skillful with it, and hopefully become free of it. This is from the African shaman, Bayo Akomolafe, who said falling might very well be flying without the tyranny of coordinates. Learning how to let go of our reactivity may be like, often feels like falling, like we can't find our ground. We're so used to our reactivity. We're so used to just responding from our fear or our anger or our grief, instead of being with it and letting it wake us up more fully. And then the possible, the positive can happen. And there's something that's now called post-traumatic growth, right? You all know about post-traumatic stress, but post-traumatic growth is about people who thrive in the aftermath of adversity. And an artist, remember how Thich Nhat Hanh said, it's an art practice and working with suffering. There's a famous artist, which many of you know, Frida Kahlo, who it's talked about in this book called Wired to Create. And they said one of her most famous self-portraits depicts her in a hospital bed, naked and bleeding, actually in Henry Ford Hospital in 1932. And I know Henry Ford Hospital because it's in Detroit and I grew up in Detroit. And so they say it's a powerful artistic rendering of her second miscarriage. And she wrote in her diaries that the painting carries with it the message of pain. And she's known for her channeling her experience of multiple miscarriages, childhood polio, and a number of other misfortunes into her iconic self-portraits, Real Understanding of Suffering, and the Real Understanding of Suffering that motivated it. And then this term post-traumatic growth is part of what we're talking about now. She grew from her trauma, from her heartache, from her difficulty, from her suffering. And the people who write about post-traumatic growth, they said up to 70% of trauma survivors report some positive psychological growth, research has found. Growth after trauma can take a number of different forms, including a greater appreciation for life, the identification of new possibilities for one's life, more satisfying interpersonal relationships, a richer spiritual life, and a connection to something greater than oneself. And they also said that experiences of trauma commonly lead to increased empathy and altruism and a motivation to act for the benefit of others. And there's I'll end with a beautiful poem for Rashini, who said, there is a brokenness out of which comes the unbroken. There is a brokenness out of which comes the unbroken. A shatteredness out of which comes the unshatterable. There is a sorrow beyond all grief, which leads to joy, and a fragility out of whose depths emerges strength. There is a space too vast for words through which we pass with each loss, out of whose darkness we are sanctioned into being. There is a cry deeper than all sound whose serrated edges cut the heart as we break open to the place inside of us, inside which is unbreakable and whole. W-H-O-L-E, as we break open to the place inside which is unbreakable and whole while learning to sing. So those are a few thoughts about dukkha, grace, practice, the Dharma, our own essential nature, and what's right here. So I always love to hear your thoughts or your questions or your comments or your reactions, or if something didn't make sense And we have some time for comments, questions. And don't be shy, because we don't have a lot of time.
Clint has his hand up. Go ahead, Clint. can unmute.
Hi, Clint.
Hi, Eugene. It's great to see you again. You talked about how seemingly random events have some kind of connection with each other, and the increased recognition of things greater than ourselves. I wonder if you can talk about synchronicity, which seems to embody that. In my life, I've had some amazing coincidences that couldn't be coincidences because they're so improbable. Uh-huh. And whenever that has happened, I feel like something is in touch with me that I'm not aware of, but I'm not quite sure what it is. But I just feel like I'm in a connection that I wasn't in before. And I wonder if you could talk a little bit about synchronicity and what that implies.
It sounds great. I like what you're saying. It just means that it's a little bit like the word I use, apophenia, which is the perception of connections or meaning in unrelated or random phenomena. It's synchronous. It fits, even though we might not understand why or how. And that's how I'm understanding what you're pointing at in your own direct experience, which is, of course, where the whole Dharma is in your experience. So I that's really how I'm hearing it, a little like apophenia. So you could use that word, too, if you want two words today.
Well, when apophenia happens, what do you think happens? I mean, what do you think brought that up? Brought that together, where sometimes we have these experiences.
Right. I don't know. I think it's good fortune. I think it's grace. I think it's blessings in that way.
I'm always tempted to buy a lottery ticket right after one of those experiences.
Well, buy a few for all of us, if you're going to win. But who knows why anybody wins, right?
Right.
That's just totally luck and, good luck.
Thank you.
Sure. Thank you.
Thank you for your talk. So I just wanted to quickly just reference, who got us into that war was also the administration that was, serving at the time of 2001.
Yeah. Yeah,
and he was a fake cowboy on some level, and America has this cowboy, perspective about itself, and I think that cowboys don't like to feel vulnerable.
You think it's only cowboys who don't like to feel vulnerable?
Well, I mean, I'm just saying that there's the cowboy aspect of our culture, right?
I get that. That makes sense. Of course,
that challenge of feeling vulnerable.
Pardon?
And that challenge for cowboys to feel vulnerable.
Right. And that was really hard for him. And he suffered a lot around that. And I think it's really important to see the suffering of perpetrators, not just their ignorance.
I have a hard time with that because of his, deciding to go for oil to Iraq. There's a lot of challenge in having, I can have the compassion on the largest scale, but no matter what, he still perpetrated to the degree that he did.
Right. But compassion doesn't mean that you're not clear and you're not discerning of what ignorance is also. And you can have both. Yeah. So that's all. I'm just bringing in the compassion piece because you sound a little angry about our friend, Mr. Bush.
Yeah, and I think anger is, has a place as well.
I think it has a place.
Part of the mix.
I think so, especially the energy of anger, not just the reaction of anger.
Of course.
Okay.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
Yeah. And I think that kind of brings me to the final. I just wanted to, you referenced Frida Kahlo, and one of my favorite quotes of hers is she says, "I hope the exit is joyful, and I hope never to return."
She sounds very
beauty in that reflection.
Yeah, she sounds very Theravadan in her Buddhism. Yeah, well, may she have gotten what she wants. Yeah, great. Thank you, Jason. Nice to meet you.
Marcelo is next.
Yeah, hello, everybody. I definitely see that running away from suffering can lead to more suffering or is likely to. And also, yeah, that the only way to actually transform it is actually look at the suffering. So my question would be, let's say, so if you suffer in a relationship, for example, or maybe less dramatic, a job, mm-hmm. or something as simple as, you know, sitting and maybe mm-hmm. not feeling mm-hmm. comfortable. So then there's, you know, dukkha arises. So when is the time, like, how do you realize, okay, I'm just being flaky and just want to evade the suffering and don't want to practice? And when is it like really enough? You know what I mean?
Right. Yeah. It's a great question you're asking, because it's really, you're the only one who can answer it. Right. Because there's not anybody, I can't live in your body, heart, and mind and say, oh, that's enough, Marcelo, you know, get out of here, or, you know, sit up straighter, you know, or whatever the dukkha is that you're working with. And so it's really part, you're really pointing at something to look at very clearly in your own practice, is what does it mean to be impeccable in sitting practice and in relationship? And that impeccability brings in all the qualities of Dharma that are needed, meaning being able to discern and be truthful and honest, and also center oneself in one's body, heart, and mind, use one's intelligence. And so it's an ongoing question that's a living question that you're asking. Like for myself, you know, it's like sometimes I sit every morning as soon as I get up, you know, or I stretch a little and then I sit. And it's like, how long to sit? And so I used to sit 45 minutes every day. Well, I don't sit 45 minutes anymore. I'm older now. I'm happy if I sit 30 minutes. And often I set a clock and, you know, a bell rings and I'm done. But sometimes I don't set a clock and I don't know how long I sit. And that's okay, too. And sometimes I'm sitting for 2 minutes and I feel like getting up and I'm like, no, Eugene, you sit here. and it's not with a harshness, actually, but it's just there's a part of me, I want to sit here. And then there's a part of me, I don't want to sit here. And so who do I want running the show? I want the one who's most skillful. And the one who wants to sit is a little more, you know, skillful than the one who just wants to do whatever the hell he wants all the time. And so that's a kind of, and then it's the same in relationship or in, you know, it's like, you know, I've been married for a long time, almost 30 years, but that doesn't mean it's easy. It's still people. People are, you know, great and people are a pain in the butt. And so it's like at some point, you know, how to be honest and real and truthful and here with my partner, right? At the same time. And that's a living practice. So those are a few thoughts. How does that sound?
Yeah. Sounds like a challenge, but sounds like, yeah, being true to yourself and always re-examining and seeing, yeah, am I trying to talk myself into something?
Yeah. And you know when you're trying to talk yourself into something, and you know, and you keep looking, what's true? I'm pointing at myself, but really I'm pointing at you. Keep looking right here, because that's where the answer is.
Thank you.
Great. You're welcome. Good to meet you. Hi, Jeff. I know you, Jeff.
Hi, Eugene.
Hi.
I want to touch on apophenia again.
That's great.
And this successful experience I've had recently, 2 days ago, my first college professor and spiritual mentor died. And it was somewhat quick, but not unexpected. And a mutual friend and student was able to be there and sort of text me and communicate with me, you know, blow by blow, and even sent a couple of pictures, you know, before and after. And I got a voicemail when I had just gotten up to a park to go for a walk with a friend, and said, if you get this in the next couple of minutes, give me a call. So it was in a bad cell reception area, but I got out of the car because I knew I had to stand up and sort of really show up for this. And he answered, my friend answered, said, go ahead, he can hear you. And I said, Charles, I'm so grateful that I got to see you last spring and express how much you've meant to me over the years. And that we got to, we know each other's hearts, and that I feel complete with you. And I heard him say, me too, Jeff. And I've never felt that complete.
It's beautiful, Jeff. Thank you for sharing him with all of us. And as I hear it, the love that's here for him. And yeah, thank you. Sometimes it's that simple, you know, and it's great to be able to have some words with someone before they die, before their body dies. Right? You can keep communicating with him. Who knows what'll happen, really? And I mean that quite sincerely.
Yeah. I felt so vulnerable, you know, saying that. I knew there was a room full of people.
Yeah. But, yeah.
It had to be said.
So. Yeah. Great. Thank you.
Greg?
Hi, Eugene. Thanks for your talk. I go through periods of depression every year or two, and my question is sort of related to Marcelo's, I think. I have the issue of automatically pushing away negative feelings and negative thoughts, or getting into them and sort of getting swamped by them.
Right.
And what has worked for me was to acknowledge them and say, I let you go. That feels to me like not really being with the dukkha, but it seems like a sort of a middle way.
No, that's really good what you're saying. And, you know, for some people with certain kinds of dukkha, you want to do that. You want to be aware of the dukkha. You don't just want to go into it. Because getting imbalanced, like the one thing in meditation practice you don't want to do is get too imbalanced. And you only want to get imbalanced if you can be okay on upside down, right? And if you're okay, then you're balanced even when you're imbalanced. But if you're not good with the imbalance, don't do it. You want to stay. You want to bring enough balance and partly you get one gets balanced by moving away from something that is imbalancing. And so I'm glad you're saying this and putting it into room, because the Dharma is not a one button suits everybody, really.
Right. Okay. Thank you very much.
Great. Thank you. And that's good, because we're right on time. I think we're on time. Is that right?
Yep, we are.
Okay, great.
Thank you so much. And now is the time that we ask for any announcements. Anything out there?
Yes, just to The retreat was 12th to the 14th of November, has been postponed, but we are having a day-long Zoom retreat on the 13th. Stephen Turney will still be our teacher, and details to exactly how that's going to unfold will be coming shortly. Apologies for having to postpone, but it seemed the thing we had to do.
Thank you. Any other announcements?
I'm teaching tonight at San Francisco Insight at 6 o'clock. If you want to hear a talk, it's actually going to be more about 9/11 and things like that. And so.
All right. I'll make the announcement.
I have a question. Do you do a little sharing of merit attend or anything? Can we do that?
Yes, we do a dedication of merit.
Great.
Our standard one, or you can offer your own.
Yeah. No, let's go with the standard one. I like yours. I remember yours now.
Okay. But before that, we'll just talk about Dana, which is the Pali word for generosity. And remember that your Dana through the GBF helps to send out our newsletters to incarcerated Buddhists and pay the rent on Bartlett Street and the Zoom fees and all that sort of thing. And pay for our teacher honorariums as well. So you can go and pay by PayPal. It's very quick and easy. Or you can pay by check. And then next week, our teacher is Alan Levin. And I think that about wraps up our announcements. Anybody else? All right, then I will read our dedication of merit. By the power and truth of this practice, may all beings have happiness and the causes of happiness. May all be free from sorrow and the causes of sorrow. May all never be separated from the sacred happiness, which is without sorrow. And may all live in equanimity without too much attachment or too much aversion, believing in the equality of all that live. Thank you, everyone.
Thank you, everyone. Good to be with you all. I hope everybody gets to stay healthy as possible.
Thanks, Eugene.
Thanks, everyone.
Thanks, Eugene.
Thank you.
Bye, everybody.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Thank you for listening to the Gay Buddhist Forum. If you would like to hear several new talks per month and be notified of upcoming speakers so you can participate live, please subscribe to this podcast, like us on Facebook, and join our mailing list by visiting gaybuddhist.org.